This special Seagraph edition of This Week in Media is sponsored by Maxon, developers of Cinema 4D, the must-have 3D package for motion graphics professionals. Maxon is currently offering up to 50% off their most popular bundles of Cinema 4D. Good until August 31st, 2010. Visit maxon.net for more information. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex Lindsay, and this is a special Seagraph edition. Now, if you're expecting a general talk about the business of media, you might want to skip this show because we're going to go geek. We're going geek. We have Mike Seymour here from FX PhD. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how are you?
It's good to see you.
So this is your alternate hosting, right? Like, it's your turn. It's mail week.
Exactly, exactly. Normally we're talking about all the business stuff. And today, I mean, so Seagraph, for those of you listening who haven't heard us do a Seagraph event before, Seagraph is the biggest graphics conference, I think. Is it the biggest graphics conference in the world? And so, NAB is a big video conference. We covered Cinegear, which is a big equipment conference. And Seagraph is the big graphics conference every year.
And I think the really significant thing, Alex, is that whereas the other two shows you mentioned are incredible, and we go to them, they're great, they tend to focus on those people that are turning up with stands, turning up to show stuff, terribly much like the productization of the industry, because you go to them for the trade show.
Right.
Whereas here, you don't go for the trade show. You go for the papers, the speeches, and the people. And it's hard to sort of grasp that when somebody says it, but you're literally walking around the halls, and if you know anything about our industry, it's the who's who that you're just standing next to in the Starbucks queue.
Absolutely. I run into like half the guys at least that I worked with at ILM, you know, every time, just wandering through wherever, you know, and so it is much more of a, it has both the feeling of a much more grassroots kind of approach to things, as well as a little less organized than some of the other ones, but still, it still has that kind of edgy feel that you don't feel.
Well, you'd know Alan Kay, right? The Apple guru from years gone. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I went to a lecture of his very early on, and he made this simple assertion, which I've actually kept with me all this time, which is, if you sort of suddenly look at some new piece of tech and go, oh my God, that's amazing that they invented that. Wow, I didn't see that coming. Right. Then you haven't been to a sort of a Seagraph. Because what happens is somebody will publish an initial idea at an almost theoretical level, and it doesn't quite work, but we all can see that it will work.
Right.
And then the year after that, someone will refine it, and the year after that, someone will do a course on it, and the year after that, it starts to get productized, and then it suddenly hits. Right. And these things do not come out of thin air. If you want to see where these ideas are coming from, they'll be nearly always first published here at Seagraph. And so you do, honestly, get a glimpse. And I think we'll be discussing this today, because quite frankly, from my point of view, that's exactly what's happening right now with cameras. If you want to know what's going on with cameras, ironically, Seagraph is the place to find out.
So what is going on with cameras?
Well, I hit on this basically because I think it's something that I know you're interested in, but also because it was one of the first lecture sessions I went to for computational photography.
Right.
So now, the best way to think about this in simple terms, to use an sort of thing, is I got my SLR, you've got your SLR, and they're great, right? And we think of them as being really cool digital cameras that do really cool actually, if you sort of break it apart a bit, there are actually two parts to your camera. There's the digital sensor, totally cool, love it, with all of the stuff that goes with that, like the focus and the exposure stuff, but really in computational terms, not that hard. I mean, it's not being dismissive, but like, it's not that hard to get exposure right in terms of the amount of computer power you need for it.
Right.
The rest of the digital part of your camera, the rest of the computer part, is simply there to dumb it down. It dumps it down to MPEG, it dumps it down to JPEG, it does everything it can to get it stupider and give it to you, which is great if you want to quickly get a picture.
Right.
Now, the iPhone goes the exact opposite way, right? It doesn't have a particularly good API or computer system for operating the camera, because it's not fundamentally a camera. But everything after that, in terms of the apps, are about making the camera smarter. So think about it, right? You take the photo, and it'll stitch stuff together. It'll try and do all this cool stuff. And we all love that stuff, right?
Right.
So computational photography is mixing those two together. It's saying, hey, what if I had a computer in the camera whose sole ability it was to make the pictures better? Quite often make the files larger, but just do cool stuff I can't otherwise do. And if you think about the sensor for a second, the sensor is independent of the processing in your iPhone. It's not like the API, well, you guys do this, you write more apps than I do. The API can't actually get at the sensor that hard in an iPhone. And in other phones, it's actually worse, with probably the exception of the Nokia.
Well, the sensor isn't really even worth going to, you know, the lens and the sensor aren't really worth getting a hold of in the iPhone. I mean, other than just go grab something.
Okay, but let me give you a good example of computational photography to make this a lot simpler. So the computational photography guys have actual working prototypes. This is not like a theoretical paper. And they call it the Franken camera, which I just love.
Yeah.
And so they have two versions. They have a big one, which actually uses SLR lenses, and they have a small one, which actually runs on a N900 Nokia. And it's only because the Nokia has an API that lets them get out the chip.
Right.
So now we all understand that there's a really tiny little sensor in a phone and a big sensor in like a 5D. Well, if you were to sort of slightly drift around your phone while taking a photo, and it took lots of photos, and you had tons of computational power on the back end, it could produce a virtual sensor that's much larger than the little sensor that you actually have. And so here you've got this tiny little N900, and you hold it, and you kind of like, I aim it at you, right?
Right.
And normally, tiny sensor, huge amounts of depth of field.
Right.
This sucker produces a virtual sensor, and you suddenly look like you're photographed on an IMAX sensor. And how's that possible? So, yeah. Well, because it kept on contributing to the sort of virtual sensor as it got moved around. And it can do that because the computer has the gyroscope, the accelerometer, and the GPS to know what it's doing, and it fires the pictures.
Well, and that's one of the things that there's a new application for the iPhone called the You Gotta See This from the Boinks guys, where it is, you do the same thing where you just kind of hold, you turn it on and you just kind of move around. And what they do is they're building a photo collage. And the first thing I did when I saw it, I was like, okay, this would be really good if you just stitch those together, you know.
Absolutely. But it can't actually control sort of a ton of stuff, the API that is, of the thing. Now, I'll give you another example. And I'll start saying this and you'll immediately go, oh yeah, obviously. But let me get to the end of it. So you hold your camera up, the Franken camera thing, and you just start panning around a scene and it starts stitching that together.
Right.
Okay, this is the bit where you go, yeah, so, you know, done that. But this is where it gets clever. Because it knows where you're pointing and what you're doing and it fully controls the camera, it goes, oh, I've been over this area before. Why don't I start varying the exposure to get you HDR in that area? Because you obviously care about that a lot more.
Right.
And so I'd pan around this room, but when I got back to you, I'd put a focus more and would start tone mapping anything that I'd been over before.
Right.
And producing automatic HDR tone mapped images of that region on this super high res image.
Right.
And then it wouldn't dumb it down to a JPEG. It'd give you this bloody great file.
Exactly.
And it can only do that because the computer... and I think I actually heard you actually say on a This Week in Photography, wouldn't it be cool if I could plug my iPhone into the back of my Canon?
Yeah.
And so this is what this guy... This is effectively that. It's the idea if we could make a camera that had a decent computer at the back that fully controlled the sensor, all the aspects of the aperture, the sensor, signal-to-noise ratio, all that kind of stuff, what could we do?
Well, and I think that is... Eventually, I think that's going to be the future. The thing that the kind of the message that we've been talking about on This Week in Photography, and the message we're trying to get home somewhere in Japan, is that, you know what, we really don't need you to work on the computer anymore for the camera. You know, and I know that scares them because that's how they differentiate their cameras. That's how they do all this stuff. But we don't want you to work on that. And I think that the company that's mostly the best poised for that is a company like Sigma, which isn't really making a lot of. They've got a sensor that's special. You know, the Foveon sensor. They've got lenses. You know, that they make a lot of money on. But they don't have a camera that people are particularly excited about. And so the thing is that, you know, it would give me an entirely new market of having an SLR with a slide in for my iPhone 4. And the thing is then you end up open sourcing your camera, essentially, you know, where you now have your little slot and you just slide the iPhone in, it becomes the LCD for your camera. And then people can just write software for that camera, you know, that is going to simply, you know, run the sensor. Because that's all we need from them is the sensor and the body, you know, to kind of, you know, wrap around it.
And a really good API to control that camera. I think that may happen because it's so sexy to have a click in. But I think the thing for me is the anecdotal stuff of what's actually happening. So this is not developed by a corporation. This is developed by MIT. I think it's MIT or Stanford.
I think it's Stanford.
Yeah, Stanford.
The Franken camera?
Yeah. So the Stanford guys get all these N900s because they're pretty cheap.
Yeah.
And they give them to all their students. And they say, guys, we've got a donation of like a bunch of cameras. Why don't you take them and come back next week as your assignment and see if you can write some kind of focusing system for the 900 as an exercise. Right. You know, you're a student. It seems like a reasonable thing. Except for this is Stanford, right? Which is, you know...
Yeah,
kick-ass mega dudes.
Right.
Okay, you know, we're not worthy. So apparently 3/4 of them came back with a focusing system that was better than Nokia's,
right,
and twice as fast.
Right.
And they went back to Nokia and said, well, this is what we get in a week. And Nokia, what? You did what?
So they got a couple more cameras.
And so, yeah, so they got a bunch of cameras. So then they said, okay, see what you can do in a month. Mm-hmm. And so then they went off and started doing these additional stuff. Now, they have also got a big camera, which I don't know how I'm going to show you this, but there's a big version of it. But it's a... I don't know if you can even see that. But it's a big version that is the mother, and that's F2. They're right. about to go to F3, which will have a bigger sensor. But it's just no... like this is just one of the computational photography areas. But there's no exaggeration to say that once you take the camera and try and let the computer at the back of it produce a higher res, higher depth, bit depth, sort of more intelligent picture, that you're going to get some really amazing stuff. And then secondly, as you say, open source it to the community, which is exactly what this is, all open source. And it's just going to blow the lid off photography. And I think that it's a perfect storm, right? Because we've already seen it works with the iPhone.
Right.
There's money to be made. And companies like Nokia get knocked off their block by just having these students come back after a week and do better than their R&D engineers can do in 6 months.
Right.
So unfortunately, if you're wondering, and everybody asked this question, why didn't they do it with an iPhone? Wouldn't it be cool? Apparently, the Apple API is worse than the Nokia one for getting access to the sensor.
Well, it's harder to get access to the sensor. It's harder to integrate it with any kind of hardware. It's hard. There's a huge... you talk to anyone who's been developing, trying to integrate with that USB connection to the bottom of, in your iPhone, and it's, going through that with Apple is no minor incursion, so that's one of the big issues there.
And if anyone's interested and you have a Nokia, which a friend of mine, Zap from Sweden, was all raving about, he literally downloaded it and it's got it running on his phone and it has test demo stuff on there and you can immediately start just having a play with it. It's all, and I'm sure Nokia is going to include this as part of their API. And
yeah, absolutely. Now, so other things at Seagraph. Now, while we talked about some of the technology, any other big papers, anything else that we see that's jumping out?
Before we get to that, 8 minutes of Tron yesterday.
I missed it.
I just want to know, is Alex all right? I mean, what have you done with him?
I
just need to know. Hello?
No, so what happened was is
you
that...
missed 8 minutes of Tron with the director and the producer and the visual effects crew.
I sent Jerome, who's visiting here from Rwanda.
Out,
no,
it's in 3D.
He went
Am I rubbing it in enough yet? Okay.
So here's the problem is that while a lot of people don't have the... while a lot of people don't pay, aren't paying attention to the expo, we cover the expo. And so I had a short window to make sure that I had all my notes done for today. Cause today we run around and shoot 35 episodes. And the timing of when that showed up was overlapped to timing that I needed to cover it. And so, I took a bullet for the crowd. Now I did go to we'll talk about Tron. And then did you go to see the Avatar stuff last night?
I did not see it last night. There have been multiple Avatar papers, including Joe's summary one yesterday, mm-hmm. where he went through most of the stuff, which has been excellent, right? Because obviously Avatar is a film that is worthy of this kind of stuff.
Right. But Tron was... I will admit it hurt because I'm so excited to see Tron.
Yeah, and also it's technologically really interesting because there's the young Jeff Bridges.
Right.
And so what they're doing, which is, of course, why it's so interesting to Seagraph audiences, they're not just doing the Benjamin Button thing where they had Brad in a separate room and they sort of filmed him on a stage and then they took that and applied it. They've actually got Jeff Bridges on set actually acting, and he has four cameras in a camera helmet that's recording his performance to the other actors, and then they're lifting that performance, which is given interactively, and then putting that in a younger version on the body of a body double to play the younger version of himself. And it looks good, man. I mean, Benjamin Button, right, was so good.
Right.
And it, this is like mind-numbingly hard. And then they made it stereoscopic. And to give you an idea how hard this was, the director started buying boxes of Patron tequila for the tracking team because of all the things they've been doing. And a friend of mine's, works at DD, so I can totally validate this isn't hype. It's so hard with the tracking that... that they were giving boxes of Patron to the tracking team as kind of bribes and thank yous. And then someone at Patron heard about this, and the president apparently sent an autographed box of Patron to the production to say thanks for increasing the annual sales of Patron. But,
Well, and the thing is that when you get to tracking at that level, you're no longer talking about letting the tracker do anything. You're really, for the 2D tracks that feed into that, you're really talking about roto tracking.
Well, you can't do any 2D tracks because it's a 3D stereoscopic view. So they have to do... because the whole thing here is the deep compositing. So they can't even do the 2D tracks. They have to do full three-dimensional tracks. And it's black. And they're wearing black suits with batteries producing those neon lines, from the original Tron.
Right.
And those suits are some of the most expensive costumes ever made.
Right.
So and they're neon and they're glowing, so you can't get a good tracking corner.
Yeah.
And it's object tracking in a black environment. Oh my God, it just goes on and on and on. Anyway, so, but having said that, like, it's obvious that Disney is totally trying to make this the next, you know, major franchise. They get 18 months in post versus what's the normal, like, six.
Right. And what's the release date on Tron?
December.
Right.
And they were at Comic-Con. And then, yes, they had the director, the producer, and the effects team. And, you know, it was great. They played 8 minutes in stereo in real D. I'm not an undying fan of 3D. I think especially some of the dimensionalized stuff sucks. But in this particular case, the director took the attitude of having it as a window on the world. So most of the 3D existed beyond the image plane of the screen rather than the gimmicky stuff that, you know, comes out in your face. And so it just looked immersive and cool. And
You shoot it that way, they're shooting it. Are they?
Oh, totally, yeah.
So, and that's the whole thing. And they're shooting it on, what were they?
F-35s. In a, you know, what was obviously like a massively heavy, you know how heavy an F-35 is.
And then the rig is...
And they had up to three F-35 dual rigs running at once, several witness cameras, and the four camera head rig on his head. Can you imagine doing the clapper for that? I need my 18 cameras to be in sync now, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. It's great. And, you know, DD, credit to them. Like, they're one of the major houses, and they're doing really good work.
Yeah, absolutely. And the... now also something that this has been really been getting a lot of, you know, behind the scenes. I went to Giant Studios last night, and they had the big kind of breakdown and of everything of the Avatar stuff. And what's amazing is when you look at any of this, whether it's Tron or Avatar or anything else, you realize that most of the stuff was done 3 or 4 years ago. You know, when you look at the Avatar stuff, they were showing us technology and, oh yeah, we were doing it with the technology that was 5 years old because that's when we were doing the actual work.
Yep. Yep. Though, in the case of Avatar, there is a bunch of GPU stuff that they were doing, especially with some of the processing stuff, that because it came later in the production cycle, I think is absolutely completely cutting edge.
Yeah.
And also, you know, because you've got a project like that and you know, like Joe Leteri, who's the visual effects supervisor from Weta, you know, really obviously very, very good guy, he was saying that the first shot they did in Avatar took them, this isn't the exact number, but something like 10 months to do the first shot.
Right.
And the audience was like, what? And they're like, well, yeah, because we knew we had to get the pipeline down and automate it so that when we got to the last 6 weeks of crunch, it wasn't going to take 10 months. Like,
right.
We had to keep on getting that shot as a flowed automatically through rather than like handcrafted thing.
Right.
Because if it was handcrafted, we'd never get the volume through. So they are developing the tech as they go along. But you're absolutely right. Like, from a outsider's point of view, you think this is like the most cutting edge stuff. But some of it's like 5 years old.
It's kind of like NASA. You know, you see the shuttle, and the shuttle's all 70s technology that's taking us to space, you know, because that's what it was designed in.
Can I tell you one other anecdote? Sorry, because it just segues perfectly what you said. You know, I said earlier that it's walking around, it's the people you see. So there was a session on the Tuesday, I think it was, and it was described as calibrating your digital sensor and your camera. I'm like, well, that's the kind of geeky thing I want to go to.
Right.
So I turn up to this geeky thing, and Sid Graff had it as a tiny little thing in one of the non-major areas. In fact, it was, I think, where the emerging technologies is. And it was like where Wacom was. And because it was kind of ad hoc and whatever, they'd rescheduled the time that morning. So I turn up with four of my hardcore geeky friends to discuss digital sensors, as does the guys giving the talk. And they said, oh, no, it's on at 2. And I'm like, well, I can't go at 2. I've got another thing on. And he's just standing there. And I said, well, Lee, this is the guy's giving the talk, can we just buy your coffee? Because we just so wanted to hear this talk. And clearly you've got nothing on for the next 45 minutes as you thought you were talking.
Right.
You know, could we just have you? So we sit down with this guy. Now, I didn't know Lee when I went there.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew he was talking about digital sensor and it read well. Well, myself and about 8 guys end up sitting around with this guy. I'm halfway through the conversation. I said, God, Lee, you just know more about this than I'm. And what's your background?
Right.
And he said, well, after we were finished designing the Apollo cameras for the moon landing, and we were like, what? Back up, what?
Welcome to SeaGrab.
Yeah, exactly. And then he just started discussing the issues of film in cameras where you can't look through the lens. The photography is rather important.
Right.
You want to be able to do stereoscopic kind of calibration of work out the size of objects in the photo without having to be able to measure them because they couldn't bounce around much. But also things like zero gravity, the pressure differential, because if they worked out with a camera, the vast temperature differential, and the fact you couldn't expose the film for a while, right? Because there's no lab.
Right, yeah. So you have no idea when they come back whether there's anything to look at.
So while I got quite a lot about digital sensors out of that discussion, the rest of the discussion was him telling us anecdotes like NASA said that if the, and luckily this didn't happen, but if the reentry vehicle had burned up, that the rocks and the film would have made it back through. because they were in such bulletproof boxes. You know, it was like black box on steroids.
A lot of times that's how I feel like I travel. So when I'm traveling around the world, or, you know, I'll be shooting in Africa or whatever, the only thing I worry about is the data. Like, the data is in three places. It's in two different bags. One's on me, one's on somewhere else. You know, there's all these different things that I do. I upload like base versions of everything. And it's like I don't know if I'm going to get back, but I'm going to make sure the data actually gets back that I actually
And you gather. Know, it's like when you get to sit down with an ex-Hasselblad guy who fully understands digital sensors, who's right. willing to geek out to a level that, you know, is pushing your knowledge right. and is happy just to have a coffee with you. I mean, it's like heaven, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you must – what have you found that's –
Well, I walk through the expo. You know, I'm looking at, you know, because my issue is that that's what we cover.
Sure.
You know, it's harder to shoot in the other areas. And so you're not allowed to shoot. I get this long paper of what I'm allowed to shoot and what I'm not allowed
oh, really?
To shoot here. And you know, papers.
Who gives you
stuff.
That paper?
The press people give you
oh, really?
The paper. Yeah.
I've got a press pass, but I didn't get the piece of paper.
If you say you're going to take a camera and then they give you the paper that you have to
I got
sign.
Paper, but... I mean, I got the little green sticker.
And they didn't have a little piece of paper.
I'm going to stride in.
Don't
Aussie
it says
charm
in the back
on,
of your little press pass. It says, like don't shoot the papers.
Like you read this. The instructions.
I try to be a good press citizen okay. so that I get a press pass the next year. Because okay. I used to get kicked out all the time. So anyway, like the red.
Like the red.
So anyway.
It's not like it's unprecedented for you to be.
Yes. So anyway, so the couple things on the floor that I saw, you know, the Pixelogic just, is constantly blowing the doors. It's an interface that makes me a little crazy, you know, when I'm working with it. You know, like when I open up Mudbox, I feel more comfortable from a CG artist's perspective of, oh, I understand how all this works. And I, you know, love a lot of the tools. But did you see some of their new modeling tools, the Shadowcaster? And
I have not seen that yet, no.
So they have, you know, what Pixelogic really focuses on, of course, that ZBrush is their... For those of you listening who are not dealing with all of this, ZBrush is this application that they have been developing for years. And it was funny, the first time that they had ZBrush, I think it was 96 or 97, and I walked up and I said, they're showing 3D painting and everything else. I was like, so how do you export an OBJ? And they're like, why would you want to export an OBJ? And they're just looking at him going, so just so you know, that would be a really big deal. And I don't think I was the only person that said that to him, because soon after that, they were exporting OBJs. And now... their biggest market is, of course, building these 3D models, you know, but what they've done is that they really look at modeling from an artist's perspective. How do we make it easy for the artist? How do we make it something that anybody can do and just kind of paint through? And once you get into their interface, you really have to wrap your head around the way that they have found their way to where they're going. You have these things called Shadowcaster, so you can sit there and just start drawing stuff like really quickly. And it's literally just building a 3D model. I mean, it's just building the 3D model while you're drawing. But you're drawing in 2D, and you can kind of rotate and draw some more, and it builds some more, and then you can then use all the other tools that they have, you know, to make that work. But they were building, you know, furniture and really complex parts and all these other things. Now, of course, it doesn't have the precision that we're going to get with a Maya or XSI or Modo or whatever, you know, as far as the modeling goes. But for throwing stuff together, it's amazing how pretty, you know, a lot of that stuff comes out. And if you're trying to hack something together, it is, it really, you know, works well, you know. And so that was, you know, I found that to be, you know, interesting. I haven't played with it yet, so I don't know. Other things that I saw, I don't know if you saw, I mean, there's a lot of scanners have become very cheap. You know, so it's exciting. There's whether it's, I don't know if you play with the next now I'm gonna forget the name of the and it's so bad because I have Next Engine. Have you seen the Next Engine scanner?
Yep.
So
yep.
Do you have one of those?
I do not.
We have one at okay. the office, and it's really nice. And so, but it's a $2,000 scanner that is scanning, you know, little. It's the kind of thing that it's gotten to the point where you can put it on your desk, you know, and just scan reference stuff. Like I don't, because I never really got to the point where I was using the scans. When I was at ILM, the scans were still beginning, and so we just used them as 3D templates. You know, so the idea that I can scan something and now I just have the base unit that I can then cut up and build models from, and so on and so forth, is one of the key, you know, is key for me. And so then there's Three River Scanner, which is from Pittsburgh, so I have to give them a heads up. There, it's same kind of thing, a bit more expensive, the $15,000 range, but it is, it's really fast, so 5 seconds that you get it back. Other things that we saw while I was walking around, I'm trying to think of other things on the floor.
So
now I'm.
So I'm going to jump in with one because I had a writer on coming on the show that I wasn't going to talk about iPhones or AT&T, but I am going to talk to you about one because I thought you might want to hit me with media things that I thought was particularly interesting to do with the iPad.
Oh yeah, you're talking about Autodesk.
I was actually talking about about Mental Images and Mental Ray.
I didn't see that.
Okay, so. So Mental Ray has an iPad thing. And now, having an iPad app is not particularly sexy, right? Obviously, everybody has iPad apps. But the iPad app that they have is indicative of an underlying technology that's really cool. I'm just going to get a picture of it up here. I'll get it in a second. So they have an iPad app, and up comes this really detailed model, right? And so you go, and it's a picture. It's like ray-traced.
Right.
And you go, okay, pretty cool. And it's a gallery. And they go, no. And then you flick it, and it turns around. And then you go, so it's... VR sort of thing, and they go, no, really, try doing anything. And so you do anything to the model and it just comes back ray traced, and you go, well, there's no way that this thing is ray tracing the picture. And they go, no, we've just done a deal with two major companies for cloud computing, and what's happening is the model is being fully ray traced out on the cloud and just coming back to you over Wi-Fi. And so the fact they're doing it on an iPad is irrelevant. It
right.
could be 4K and right. they're just shrinking it down to display, because you have a massive like fully industrial strength render farm that's doing GPU right. rendering with the new iRay stuff that Mental Images, which is one of the two big render companies, Pixar make RenderMan and Mental Images make Mental Ray. So Mental Ray has a new GPU version. The GPU stuff is super, super fast. But more importantly, you put the GPU stuff, which is all real-world energy-conserving lighting modeling stuff. It's not like hacks. It's proper, full-on,
right.
hardcore mega stuff. And the idea is that if I'm a mid-level company and I suddenly need to produce out a ton of top-end stuff, I just buy some render hours.
Right.
But as opposed to having to fuss with it, it's just all streamlined. Right. And so they're literally just walking around the show floor, rendering these super high-resolution, ray tracing, very computationally expensive stuff. On the iPad, though, the iPad does nothing but basically act as a monitor to God knows where a stack right. of computers are sitting, which I thought was pretty cool.
No, absolutely. And it is because the iPad is capable of doing a fair bit of 3D rendering, surprisingly good, especially real time and so on and so forth. And but when you're talking about that kind of
six
speed,
levels
being
of
able
ray
to,
bouncing,
no, being able to just send that off to the cloud, and it's something that, you know, it's the kind of the dream of all of us, just to have that rendering power. And I think that, you know, mental images is doing it. Houdini is doing some work with the Amazon S3. You know, kind of being able to send that stuff out.
Well, for those that don't know, Mental Images is owned by NVIDIA, and everybody knows NVIDIA,
which means we're going to get a lot of GPU
punch. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And more on Seagraph. Just a quick shout out and thanks to our sponsor, Maxon. Maxon is the leader in motion graphics 3D. So the stuff you see flying around, whether it's openings or digital sets or logo stuff, as well as, I mean, of course, they do a lot of other things. They do. They have character tools. They have, matte painting is a big thing. Body paint, of course, is, all of these things are things that Maxon has really excelled at within the industry. And
their party's tonight, right?
Is there a party tonight?
I think so, yeah, the Maxon party. Because Maxon throw a good party.
See, they sponsored our thing and they didn't tell me
about
the party.
I'm sure they did.
So
and there's
they
some
they
really good people down on the Maxon stand as well. Actually, like this, you know.
You know, the thing is Mac, it's almost like, one of the best booths to go to, whether you're at NAB or at Seagraph or anywhere the Maxon goes, they bring in these incredible broadcast artists. Mm-hmm. And they're not pulling punches. I mean, they're really showing you, this is how we break everything down. This is how we, you know, got these opens for whether it's, you know, ABC or someone else.
Because there's an assumed level of knowledge that the crowd is going to go. Because let's face it, it's not free to get into Seagraph. And
right.
so you're not going to get somebody coming along with their kids just for fun.
Right.
I know they have a program that brings in school children under a special different thing. But this
right.
is not a show where people would just turn up. So you assume the audience is very literate.
Right.
Hence those demos that Maxon are doing, assume you really know what you're talking about.
Well, and most of the time with demos, people are just saying, well, this is how good our product is. And Maxon kind of eschews all of that. I don't know if there is a demo where they walk you through how cool their product is. All there is okay, this is what people are doing with it. And especially when it comes to broadcast animation, along with a lot of other 3D, whether it's medical, e-learning, corporate, all these other things, this huge part of the pyramid.
Does someone have stats on market share? Because Maxon seems to have been growing in the last few years, but I've not been able to find any stats.
I don't know the total industry stats, but I believe that the last stats I heard were they were at you know, 60% of the broadcast, you know, animation market, you know, for broadcast, you know, so the, when I talk about, you know, for the logos and opens and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So that's
and
been an
area.
And
they're extending outside that as well, I think.
Oh, well, they are, because, I mean, a lot of the character tools now work really, you know, are much better than they were in the past, and they're very usable. I was just using them last week. And the body paint, of course, has been a big industry piece for a long time. And then, of course, you have a lot of their tools for matte painters have been, you know, are very, very popular in a lot of the big houses. So anyway, so thanks. If you want to check out more about Maxon, you can go to maxon.net and check out more there. I think you can download a demo of Cinema 4D, their flagship product. So anyway, thanks to Maxon. And moving back to some of the stuff from the floor, have you seen much of the OptiTrack stuff?
No, tell me about that.
So we bought one.
Okay.
I mean, a while ago.
I got to get down to the show floor after this.
Okay, so you have to see OptiTrack. So there's a lot of, you know, motion capture has been one of those things. When I started doing noodling with motion capture, we were talking about million-dollar systems. You know, 26 cameras was $1 million for a Vicon system or whatever. And then it got down to a cheap $250,000. And then people started buying six-camera systems that were $50,000 or $60,000. So this new coming company about 2 years ago had a little booth at Seagraph, 2 or 3 years ago, and they were called OptiTrack, and they had this tiny little booth, and they were saying, you can have six cameras for $6,000, and I looked at it, and I was
oh,
like,
oh yeah, I remember this, yeah.
And I was like, there is no way that works. You know, like, they were just like, that's not going to work, it's not going to go anywhere.
The thing we were worried about was whether or not the data you'd get out would need so much cleaning up as to make it not sort of worth your while.
Exactly. So I went there, and then the next year, they were a little bit bigger, and they had 12 cameras, and they, you know, and I was like, I don't know. You know, we'll see. And then last year we had, so we did some character animation for a, you know, for a couple corporate gigs, and we did it all by hand, and it was, you know, painful because especially when you have, you know, the clients really know what they want, they know where they want to go, and they say, oh, let's change a little bit of this and let's change it. And canned animation, you're just kind of like, oh, you know, that's a week down the back, you know, that we're going to throw away. When you're doing all this stuff, and it wasn't super complicated, but it did, you want it to be as lifelike as possible. So another project came in that was like that. And so what we did is we were like, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and take a chance, and we're going to buy this, you know, 18 camera system. And I think it cost us $15,000 or $18,000. And so this was, it was so low that I was like, there's no way this is going to be that good, but you know what, it'll be close enough, and then we'll clean it up, and it'll be better than hand animating it. Well, it was remarkably clean and smooth.
Oh, really?
I mean, I was actually extremely surprised. Not perfect, but no motion capture is. I mean, I've done a lot of work. We did a project for VH1 where, you know, we were getting hours of stuff from you know, from a Vicon system, and you know, it's all of it needs, you know, cleanup to some degree, you know. And so now I won't compare this necessarily head to head with Vicon, but for the price, you know, we got incredibly good data, you know, and the software that they made, it makes it really easy. We pipe it in, we can pipe it straight into Motion Builder, which is what we use to do all of our stuff. And so, and I was just looking at it for, if all we get out of it is previs and some corporate video stuff, it's worth the money.
Sure.
It's worth that small investment. And it's turned out to be a lot more. I mean, we keep on bidding on bigger and bigger jobs. They just came out with new cameras this week that are twice as big, twice the hurt, and twice the frame rate.
So what's the premise of the camera? Is it infrared? Is it
still an infrared? It's still a standard, you know, it's a standard system. The first ones ran off of USB, with the ones that we have, USB chained together with little hubs. The second one is off of Ethernet, and the first one was capped out at 24 cameras. The second one now, because it's doing a lot of the processing on board, is tops out at 96 cameras. And these guys, I think, are poised to really, you know, change the motion capture industry as far as pricing goes, because these new cameras are $2,000 each. Now, that may seem like a lot of money for those of you listening, but $36,000 for 18 cameras is still a, you know, drop in the bucket compared to what, you know, a lot of you know, other solutions look like as far as price goes.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that you need to remember when you're listening to some of this stuff is that you don't necessarily buy everything. Like, we might talk about lenses being really cool that are expensive, or this gear.
Right.
Now, you're an exception, but
I rent until it hurts.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, a production could easily rent a motion control stage for like 2 months, and you just want it to work and work really well.
Right.
And it's totally factored in. Not like the trick for any independent production, especially, is not to buy.
Right.
And so, you know, when you say it's 36,000, that also is reflected in the rental price, right? So
hopefully.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and we've gotten to the point now when we're bidding on stuff, a lot of times we're just bidding on character animation. A lot of our clients don't care how it shows up. They just want, and because it was something that we could do, and now it's based on this, what we look at is it's just saving us money because we're not we're not doing, for the kind of stuff that we're doing, we don't need hand character animation for everything that we're doing, especially when you're talking about previs. Previs, you want it to be fast in, fast out. Yeah. You want to be able to capture a bunch of data, throw it into something. We're working on a short film for the fall for a PixScore project, and we're going to do photogrammetry of the entire set, of the entire location, bring that into Motion Builder, and then have our actors in there. And then the other thing that OptiTrack just launched is a handheld rig with a monitor, which isn't the one that was used for Avatar, is extremely detailed and high powered, and it's got all these controls. What you really need is a monitor with three markers
and orientation. Yeah, get orientation,
you can feed it all back in. And so and Motion Builder's been able to do that for years. Mm-hmm. I was pretty excited about, you know, where they're going with that system. And it's amazing. They went from being this tiny little 10 by 10 booth off in the corner to now they are front when you walk in. They are next to Autodesk and actually connected to Autodesk because they've been doing some stuff back and forth.
Because Motion Builder is the default standard. There's just no question about it.
So. Yeah, and I think that Avatar, I think the best thing that ever happened to Motion Builder, of course, was Avatar. Because I think that there was a point where I think people, I was worried when Kadera was absorbed by Alias and then Alias was absorbed by Autodesk, that Motion Builder was going to, they're going to try to strip some of the incredible tools out of it, put it into Maya, and then just dump it. And I think that that the big shot in the arm, I believe, was Avatar, when people saw what you can do with it. Because a lot of us know, I mean, I have to admit that of all Autodesk's products, the one I'm most excited about is actually Motion Builder.
See, yeah, it's because you're a 3D guy at heart. I'm a compositor at heart, so.
Well, the other one that I'm really excited about that I'm just starting to play with and wrap around is Smoke.
Yeah.
So Smoke for the Mac, no longer buying big, having to buy the big GPUs. You can just build your own and put it on. You still need a big.
My first flame was literally $900,000.
Right.
And though you laugh, and it was horrendous, I didn't personally buy it, of course. It was funny because you could make a lot of money back then because very few people could get the finance to get the $900,000. Right. So once you had it, you could charge out at an hourly rate of like $1,000 an hour.
Right.
And at our peak, we were earning like literally our best month ever. We pulled $300,000 in a month.
Right.
Well, you pay off $900,000 really quickly if you can make $300,000 a month. Of course, you don't get any sleep, but at that point, you don't care, right? Because it's... But that was in the heyday of Post. But, you know.
But now with
it democratized it a lot more when it came down to price.
Well, yeah. And $15,000, while it may seem like a lot of money for a compositor, is when you look at what Smoke brings, when you look at what it's offering, it's a pretty amazing package.
Well, I went to a really good papers session yesterday, which was on literally called Blowing Shit Up. I hope I can say that. That's what the paper's called, right? And so it was ILM and a bunch of the effects guys that did 2011 from DD discussing how they break stuff apart.
Right.
And the effects guys were just like, okay, so we do all this stuff in effects animation and we just love compositors because they take our stuff that looks kind of not really real and suddenly do tricks to it and it looks real. And I got to say, like, you know, you get a high-end flame or, for that matter, of course, a Nuke and the high-end Nuke guys and the stuff that they're doing with the deep compositing. And it's really good stuff. And the power in those systems are just unbelievable.
Well, and one of the things that you know, we often have to reset folks when I'm doing training for visual effects, you know, I'll say, okay, a lot of you think that the center of your operations are in, you know, your 3D application. You know, and you need to understand that the center of your operations is in your compositor.
Well, it's,
you know, no, but everything,
it's a balance.
No, it's but what is required is the compositor really sets the pace. Because the issue is that you're going to feed all this stuff in, and the more data you give to that compositor, the more power you're going to have in it. So, for instance, you know, when I was rendering the Queen Ship or whatever, that's 22 passes, and the artistry of it was not in the 3D package. The 3D package was just sending raw data. I mean, there was no way to render it out of the 3D package, and see anything that looked useful.
Yeah.
You know, like I rendered, there was so many pieces of it. It would come into, at that time, After Effects, and I would, you know, have this huge pass render that I, and when I look back on using, I mean, nodal compositing is a lot easier to do, especially when you're doing all these pass renders and so on and so forth.
Well, and OpenEXR packages for putting the darn data in the first place.
Well, yeah, and then having just the access. I mean, like, not, you
what
know,
bit depth were you working at on that?
8.
Oh, God.
Like, when I, you know, I always look back on this and I go, hey, little whippersnappers complaining about not having 16-bit or 32-bit float. I rendered the whole thing in 8-bit.
Now I'm an Australian, and you guys do this old person voice. Are you accessing an American TV show? Because I've never got this. Every time you guys talk about stuff in the day, you do the
old
sounds
guy.
Like a guy from the country. Is that like a...
There's an old... There's,
did he sell,
I don't even know where it comes from, but it is, he sell, it's like something on a thing. Like, everybody thinks of it. You know, that it's always what
I
it is.
I thought maybe
is,
there was a guy that sold sweet bits.
No, it's probably from something, but it that affected. But everyone thinks of like the old guy who goes, back when I was your age, I used to walk
I'm happy
backwards
to know
in
that
the snow.
I remember back then, because I'm probably older than you, and I don't speak like that. I don't like thinking that I speak like that. So
I don't speak like that yet, but I will.
Okay, we will.
I need another 20 or 30 years, and I'll be you know,
put our teeth back in to discuss 8-bit.
Exactly. But the compositor, you know, really becomes that center, because if you have people who know how to, here's the big challenge is with 3D artists oftentimes, is I think it's really important to teach the 3D artists compositing, because they have to know what they're feeding them. You know, a 3D artist can get really good at stuff, but if they don't understand the compositing pipeline, they don't understand how I can, I don't need to worry about that. I can send out all these extra pieces and the compositor is going to make that work, you know, later. And sometimes, sometimes it's the TD, sometimes it's the, you know, it depends on what they're doing.
Though the thing that interests me the most, or not the most, but one of the things that really interests me the most at the moment is that the way that the lighting stuff is working, because one of the things that was discussed in the Avatar is how they've gone basically to having spherical harmonics on the lighting stuff,
right,
and the filtered importance sampling stuff, and how they're getting, for example, basically directional diffused, and
right,
that they're tending to try and do it a lot less with tricks.
Right.
I mean, they really are working hard. For example, I remember on Lord of the Rings where they started doing subsurface scattering on everything because
right,
they wanted to nail it and not do the multipass compositing.
Right.
And it's funny, I think multipass compositing is awesome, but by the same token, there's a, I don't know what it is, it's like a, there is an error margin, no matter how good the compositor is, between that. So, for example, on Weta, work on Avatar, there's a shot, you know, when they're blowing up the chip at the end?
Right.
And they get the grenade, and he throws it, and it's a tiny little shot, and the grenade kind of slids down the side of the ship, and it just gets caught in a vent
right,
of the ship. You probably won't even remember the shot, but if you saw it, you'd know it. And so just imagine a thing that looks like a, I don't know, a couple of Coke cans with some gaffer tape around them that slide down in a close-up-y shot and get caught in an air vent. That's it. Okay, they shot it 100% in camera. Why wouldn't you, right? Like, it's really
right,
easy. And then Weta started redoing the shot. And then Joe Lacherry comes on and goes, why are you redoing this shot? And the CG comp goes, it'll look better. And then in walked Cameron immediately and says, why are you redoing this shot? And so Joe Lacherry just turns around and goes, it'll look better, thinking, I hope that's true.
Right, right.
And it did.
Right.
And so then Joe Lacherry was trying to explain why that is, because this was 100% in camera. There were no actors, no reason for CG whatsoever. And the thing they came down to is they've got the lighting model so good now with this spherical harmonics that they're getting better daylight exteriors than you can get in the studio, because it's so hard to do daylight
absolutely,
exteriors in the studio, because
absolutely,
the light's a point source rather than sun, etc. And so literally they were like, they just, that was like one aha moment,
right,
when I can do this tiny little pickup in the studio. No, actually it'll look more real if we do it.
Now, but the question is are they rendering, when they hit render in their application, is it all coming out as one pass?
It's coming out with passes, but they're trying to get it as a combined file, but they do this deep compositing, so it's very much like a Z-depth compositing, and I don't mean that in a stereoscopic sense, I mean it in a volumetric sense,
right,
which can make files astronomically big.
Yeah,
I mean, we thought they were big before, right, but when you start getting sims that do particle foggy, smoky stuff, and you're being able to composite into that in a Z-spent, you know, like frames go from like 16 meg to 700 meg, I mean, it's just off the dial.
Right.
But it's interesting. I think
because I think that I agree with you. That I think that you having it all in one place or the other oftentimes makes a huge difference. I think that when I think of multipass, I think of like entirely CG scenes that I'm gonna, you know, still want to control over. I want to have post control over certain pieces to tweak it, because to get that last 2%,
yeah,
1%,
no, totally. I'm with
you.
You
don't want to grab onto those.
And that's obviously why it became so popular and why it still to this day is totally valid. I'm just seeing this trend. And I think another thing is, here's the thing, right? Like, if you get a really, really good compositor that can pull that off, get that last 2%, brilliant, totally.
Right.
But if you're trying to pump through 1,000 shots, you have 4 months. I'm not talking about Weta now, I'm talking about some other company,
right,
notionally. It isn't that easy to get that many good compositors that can totally nail what that last 2% is,
right,
with 64 parameters from 18 different passes.
Right.
I mean, that is hardcore skill.
On the other side of that, the real challenge is when if you're rendering everything in frame,
yeah,
you know, and it's going to come out that way. Now you're looking at render times of hours.
Yeah, well, so, yeah.
You know, and so the you know, when you pass a lot of that information down to your compositing, you know, for us, a lot of times that's happening in real time. You know, and so there's a lot of this final, like, this is the final piece that we want, and if we don't like a little bit of where it went, we're not going back to the original 3D. We're gonna make those adjustments. Now, of course, we want to get to a point where that all works, and I think that in the very high end, that makes sense. I think that in the, you know, I often think of the pyramid of, you know, the stuff that
sure,
we talk about is like the tiny top 1% or 2%, and then there's this, you know, all the other effects that you need.
But
to
if you
done.
Could take, no disrespect to compositors, because I consider myself one, if you could take some of the skill out of the compositing by providing more stuff that was in robust shape that needed
yeah,
less tweaking, then it's actually making it easier to have a higher volume pipeline.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, the super compositor that can just nail that last 2%, I mean, that's a really rare yeah, and valuable commodity. Take nothing away from them, but, you know, you need them on the super hard shots. It's interesting also because that'll translate down, right? Because like this thing with the iPad that I was talking about with mental images, like why that works is I don't muck around with the lighting and do tricks because it's ray traced, right? Because it's giving right, me really good natural lighting. I just set up some lights and hit render and I go, oh, right, look, Alex, my picture looks good.
Right.
So in a sense, if the more computational power you throw at it, more accurately you're modeling the lighting, the more you can actually set up real lights and do it. And, you know, that's what they did. Cameron was bringing CG guys on set because I visited Avatar and went on set. And
right,
they're bringing out compositing guys and CG guys that weren't on set and say, look, I don't want to talk to you about point source or area lights. I want to say put a flag in here, put a right, bounce in here, you know, bring in a 2K there, and then that's the language that you should use.
Right.
And ILM, especially on Iron Man and Weta, are at the forefront of doing exactly that. But that holds well for everybody else, right? Because as it filters down, as it always does,
right,
it'll mean that you get, you know, the ability to produce much better photorealistic stuff at a... Hey, can I talk to you about something else just as a tangential? Because you were talking before and I wanted to not forget this.
Yeah.
I you probably didn't make it either, but did you get to Ed Catmull's talk?
Did not.
Okay, because this is the sort of thing that I think the audience would really find amusing. So Ed Catmull is the... Well, do you want to explain who he is?
He's one of the fathers of CG. I mean, yeah, you know, essentially he was there at the beginning when you're talking about the... when you had a handful of guys working at Lucasfilm as part of the... and then ILM as part of what became Pixar.
Yeah.
So he really was at the epicenter.
And to this day, he's like, you know, sort of head of Pixar, effectively, though it's merged with Disney. And so he... Alvy Ray Smith and Jim Blinn are giving these lectures 30 years ago or 35 years ago at somewhere in the Bay Area. And HP back then
right,
had a really good policy for their engineers. They would do training for them. So they set up a microwave link to send a black and white image from the university live to the engineers, right? Because,
right,
yeah, no internet. And so they got hold of one of these original lectures from 30 years ago of this 30-year younger version of Ed giving this talk, and then they had Ed in the room, and then they would play a black and white clip from the film, and then they'd cut back to Ed. Now, some of it was really serious, and he would be discussing principles to do with hidden surface removal and whether or not, and you know, how people would in the early days say things like, and this is my algorithm, and the last line of the SIDGRAPH paper would be, and obviously to produce an anti-alias version of this would be relatively easy. And Ed would be like, whoa, if you haven't solved anti-aliasing at the beginning of the algorithm, don't even talk to me. And he was like, that's still the case. You need to worry about quality first.
Right.
So that's all serious. But then they had the funny stuff. And the funniest one, well, there's two actually. One is he closes up this clip and he just goes, 16-bit. I hate 16-bit. I hate 16-bit addressing. I really hate 16-bit addressing. Anyway, and then they cut back to Ed and was like, I still hate 16-bit addressing. And now I hate 32-bit addressing. But anyway, the other one that I thought you would find really funny is he gets up there, and this is like a young guy, 30, this is like 1980, whatever it was, and he draws on the chalkboard, and this is like black and white video, and he draws this line, and he's just talking to the students. He doesn't sort of, he's not like conscious of talking to a big audience. You know how right, you kind of intimately, you hear someone talking, and they're obviously just talking to someone just off camera?
Right.
It feels almost like he didn't know the camera was on, but obviously he did. And he says, so this is a line, and this is animation, and at this end is Pinocchio. And then he suddenly turns to someone off camera and goes, no, Pinocchio. And so over here, Pinocchio. Have you seen Pinocchio? It's Pinocchio. Pinocchio is like the best animated. Everyone would agree that Pinocchio is... So up this end, no, I'm sorry, it's Pinocchio. This end, Pinocchio. Up here is TV, Saturday morning. Have you seen when the whale with the water? It's impossible to imagine that. And this guy's arguing with him, and he's like, no, shush, Pinocchio. And then the light between his legs. It's incredible. If you haven't seen Pinocchio, you just stop talking. Anyway, and it just goes on. And then it cut back to Ed, who was just in hysterics. I mean, it was the funniest thing. But he actually went on to discuss the notion that between Saturday morning cartoons and Pinocchio was the difference between visual richness, that right. The fact that the Saturday morning cartoon guys would argue that it was distracting, that you should get to the essence of it in the way a hand cartoonist would.
Right.
Whereas in Saturday morning, which is the Pixar model, you have immense visual richness, and that actually engages people more, especially children, and that it isn't distracting to have stuff going on in the background. It isn't distracting to have that secondary animation, and that is what makes great stuff. And of course, you're watching this from 30 years ago and you're going, okay, that is where Pixar became great. You know what I mean? Like that and Lasseter and those guys thinking that 30 years ago is what made, you know, Toy Story 3 like the best film.
And if anyone hasn't seen the Pixar story, you have to see it. It's just an incredible documentary about the kind of that whole progression from the very beginning. And Lasseter making this, I mean, you don't realize how big of the turn that Lasseter made from being kicked out of Disney to now running it.
So I heard John talking years ago at SIDGRAPH, and I think it was SIDGRAPH, and it was before Pixar was Pixar. Like, it's hard to imagine Pixar not being this mega machine, but this was, you know, like, there was no certainty that it was going to work, right?
Right, right.
And in fact, they were losing money, and, you know, right. Steve Jobs was looking
Skip
after
on pumping
them.
It, yeah.
Yeah, but they would come to SIDGRAPH with films. Right. And so I wasn't there when they presented Luxo Jr., but I heard after that him talking about presenting Luxo Jr. Mm. Now, remember, one of the other people I said at that initial talk was Jim Blynn. And Jim Blynn's the guy that invented bump mapping. Like, right. You know, pick fundamental technology. And Jim Blynn was like, oh, that's a good idea. Let's perturb the surface normals. Right. We're not worthy. Yeah, okay, yeah. So, and if you've ever met Jim Blynn, he's like, you know, whatever, he is 7 foot tall and he's big beard and he's just like not a little guy. And he's a god, like, you know, pagan god. Like, I would seriously be tongue-tied if I was in the room next to him. If I was at a cocktail party with Jim Blynn, I wouldn't be able to speak. Anyway, so at this stage, John Lasseter is more like me than Jim Blynn in the sense that no one considers John Lasseter to be the pagan god and an animation genius. He was just a guy.
Yeah.
And he presented Luxo Jr. And up walks Jim Blynn afterwards and goes, hey, John, can I ask you a question about the lamp? And so John Lasseter's like, oh, my God, Jim Blynn's going to ask me a question. And so he's looking around the room for like Ed Catmull or somebody to come over to answer this question, because this is the guy that did the JPL flybys for NASA.
Right.
I mean, this is the guy that invented the art. And he's like, I'm not going to be able to answer anything Jim Blynn asked me, right?
Right.
So, you know, you scan the room for like someone to save you or ask? Yeah. And so he's doing that. And up walks Jim Blynn, who towers over Lasseter by a foot and says, with the lamp, yeah, Jim? At the end, yeah? Was that a father or a mother lamp? And John Lasseter's like, oh, God. But it was the point at which Lasseter reckoned he knew that they'd done it. Because if Jim Blynn didn't care about the fact that
they were rendered, yeah.
Yeah, then
when I got it. It's amazing to see the progression. I didn't realize how many Pixar movies I hadn't seen until I went to, I had seen, I thought, all of them. And then I went to, if you go up on iTunes and you see, and you can, you know, list Pixar movies. There were all these other little...
You mean the shorts like before?
Yeah, some of the shorts. I've seen all the... Yeah, definitely seen all the long ones. But all the shorts, and I downloaded them all for my son, my son now, you know, when we travel, he's 2.5 years old, and we just hand him an iPad with Pixar movies, and he just kind of disappears into his iPad world.
I don't know, the last couple of films, the emotional depth, like in Up, in the beginning of it, and the level of attention to the cinematography, and the fact that they were referencing Japanese silent or black and white movies of the 50s for artistic styling, the intellectualization of the process of filmmaking for the storytelling from Pixar is awe-inspiring.
I think that what I'm always amazed at, that Pixar does really well, and no one else seems to do Chris Nolan does really well. Is if you're gonna spend $100 million or $200 million on a film, it'd be great to spend maybe an extra million or two on the story, to get it ready to go. You know, the thing is that it's, you know, you're putting all this effort into this thing, and all you have to do is spend a little bit more time with a little bit, you know, with the right people to kind of tone that up and be in the right environment, and they do that. They're spending years on developing every piece and everything before they turn the machine on. And I think that's something that everyone else.
And you know the Brain Trust review. You know the Brain Trust review they do at Pixar, where basically directors give very strong notes to other directors, but you don't have to take them.
Right.
Yeah. So apparently they did it on Tron. So the Tron guys took up months ago the film to Pixar and screened it, and they did a Brain Trust on that, and they're now looking at taking that Brain Trust sort of peer review and applying it to live action films, which, I mean, made me go, good, Tron's going to be a good film.
Right, right. Yeah, and not just a big effects film.
Yeah, because let's face it, you know, there's okay, so 2012, it's VFX porn.
It is, and there's like no, you know, you're just kind of like, you could have written that a little cleaner. That's all I'm saying. You know, it's...
And what's the, who's the lead actor in that? It was Cusack, right?
Nicholas. Cusack.
I love Cusack. Man, I love that guy's films. Yeah. I would go and see that film if it just had Cusack in it and some smoke machines.
Right.
But, you know, I'd go and see it also because it had some of the best destruction sequences ever. But it was VFX exercise in excellence without a lot of...
Without a lot of substance to, to follow it up.
Then, mind you, I was just last week shooting in Yellowstone, and all I could think about was... I'm standing on an active volcano.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
There's smoke coming out of the ground here.
The message was received. So to
speak.
Now, anything else that you saw at Seagraph?
Yeah, there's one other thing that if you can tell me how it works, I would real appreciate it a lot. the Spheron 20 f-stop, 50 frame a second HD video camera shooting 1920 by 1080 with basically raw files that get converted to OpenEXR straight out of the camera from the guys that know a lot about HDR, Spheron, who, you know, everyone uses for doing on-set HDR collection. And I literally tried to get a story with them and they refused.
So they don't want to tell you anything about what they're doing.
They won't even let me go on camera and ask them questions because their attitude is they have cracked something. They're not going to explain what it is yet. They're trying to get it working fully. And if they explain it to anyone outside NDAs, then
especially at Seagraph,
they'll give everybody a heads up. They got a stand at Seagraph with the darn camera,
right?
So you can see it running. It's not like a secret. I'm not like breaking an NDA here,
right?
But you go up and try and talk to them with any press badge, and they're like, "Yeah, not so much." And I'm like, "But you know, I don't think it's personal." If you get an interview with them and he explains it, then I swear to God, I'm sending you a case of Patron. That's the bet, honestly.
The gauntlet.
FX Guide will send Pixel Core a case of Patron if you can find out whether it's a CMOS sensor and whether or not it's... Because they've got no rolling shutter. It's an electronic complete... I swear to God, you can have silver or gold, up to you. Not XO.
Okay.
Okay.
The gauntlet has been thrown. I'm gonna see what I can do. I definitely want to cover it and take a look at it. But I don't know if
because
I'll
it's the Holy Grail, questions. Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing is that you know, with whether it's filmmaking or still or whatever, you know, we saw this point where digital was getting to the point where it was the same as film or as good as film, and it was clear that once it passed it and got out in front,
stops.
It was just gonna go, you know. And I think that, but I think that's where we're going. I think we're going to this position where we're exposing 20. Basically, I think that we're very quickly approaching a world where whether we're rendering out or whether we're taking the photo, we are gathering information that we will figure out how we will expose later.
Yeah, and I would add to that with computational photography, working out where our depth of focus is.
Absolutely. Like, like literally, we're getting raw data. We're pulling in, I mean, just an incredible amount of raw data from the environment around us. And then we're going to figure out, you know, how we're going to handle that, you know, later.
So Australia has some of the best DOPs in the world. I mean, we just top DOPs on features tend to... more often than not, be Australians. And I hosted a panel of these guys in Sydney at a major event. And I asked them, if a new camera came out tomorrow, what's the one thing that would get you out of bed? You know, what's really going to turn you on? Like, is it lightweight? Is it size? Is it stereo? Every single one said latitude. They said more latitude in the shot.
And that has been the thing that has been the biggest, when you talk to DOPs, you know, in the US, in anywhere, the biggest thing is that what film gave them for a long time was a lot of latitude. You know, so what you had was you had a big target to hit.
Yeah.
So if things changed, if the exposures changed...
Well, plus they couldn't really see what they were doing.
Well, they couldn't see what they were doing. They're moving fast. And the thing we always have to remember is that, you know, when you hear that, when everyone makes fun of, and I'm sure you've talked about this before, but when people make fun of the, oh, we'll fix it in post, you know, oh, we'll handle that later. I mean, a lot of that is a producer sitting there making a math calculation on how much is that going to cost me to roto versus how much is that going to cost me to have 100 people standing there waiting for us to move the set.
Yeah.
You know, and so they're going to move on. But the thing is that when you're moving that quickly, you know, I used to poo-poo it. I was like, oh, these guys are wimps, you know, just shoot digitally and make it work and everything else. But the thing is that when I was on a set for 6 weeks and watched that whole process kind of moving through, I realized you just can't, you know, you need that large target to be able to make sure that you're capturing everything, you know, as you're, you know, and actually getting that good exposure later.
Well, at New Orleans, these guys actually, do you see how I said that? I said it like an American. New Orleans. I had no gap in the middle.
Very impressive.
Thank you. I've been practicing. So I think I'm getting a wind up, but I'm
no, stopped. No, we're just being told. I just got a message that we got about 130 people watching.
But
it's a big auditorium here, as you can see.
But at New Orleans, they showed this camera. At least they had it there, right? But the sensor bit didn't turn up, or the one of the bits didn't work out. They had the camera, they couldn't switch it on. And I was like, every day I would go back, and they say the FedEx package is in Dallas now, and I was like, and this is a company I trust. These are German, serious. I think they're German. Anyway, they're European, very very serious engineers. This is not like Dodgy Brothers, right? This is like, I know these guys. They make absolutely killer stuff, but they didn't have the camera working. And then I tracked it when it went to London. There's an obscure university, Warwick University. Well, not obscure, but you know, it's not an obvious one like MIT that had a camera, and they were testing it. I was talking to them. And so here, I just couldn't wait to get to see it. And sure enough, it's here and you can watch it. And you, light bulb, classic thing.
Right.
Here's the shot. We shot the light bulb. Let's look at the filament. Let's look at...
Now, what did they give you a price point?
No.
Is it rental only?
They have sold two. And they're not trying to sell more. They're trying to do is tidy up the technology so that they can sort of commercialize it out. And obviously that's a sensible thing to do. And I'm sure the first thing they'll do is they'll put it on some film that could require it. It'll be a bit of a cow to work with, but then they'll sort a bit more out. And then, but if they crack it, the market is so huge, they're just being sensible, right? I mean, they're doing exactly what they should be doing. They're not rushing into it. Right. Because if they can crack a commercialized standard 20 f-stops, I mean, there is no one from Arri to Red to anyone that's even in the zone.
Right.
You'll see it, and you'll do what I did, which is, can I just look? Can you just take the PL mount lens out?
Yeah.
Which you might know.
So the key is, there's gonna be a lot of. Fortunately, they're probably not watching. So what we'll do is we'll distract them.
Do anything you like. I tried that. I even said, can you just open it new? Can I just have a look at the color channels? And I actually couldn't help myself. Before I even thought about it, I reached over and started pressing the nuke controls, and that's when they closed the lid and said, you're not allowed to play anymore. I wasn't on camera or anything. It was just, I couldn't help myself. But it's the noise floor is gorgeous. I'm not really going about cameras, but I know you've got an interesting camera. So.
No, it's, well, and I think the still version of what they have was about $50,000. So we have no idea what the video version will look like.
But you know what? If you're running a feature film and you're renting this sucker, and then of course...
$50,000 equates to about $1,000 a day, something like that, and it's worth every penny if you're able to gather every set, you know, or every piece. Now this is shooting videos, so you're talking about being
50 frames a second
at 1920x1080.
Yep, they shot Avatar at 1920x1080.
You know, I'm excited about 4K, but right now, you know, like, you know, we're producing a MacBook right now in 4K.
I know, which is, you know, insane.
Well, the funny thing is,
And can I just correct you? You said you could play it. I heard you're doing it
on a CMS play. I was wrong.
And you're wrong. Thank you.
Yeah. So
I'm sitting there yelling at my car radio. No, you can't, Alex.
Well, I
have a dialogue with you quite often when I'm driving to work.
Yeah, exactly. So there is actually almost no. I mean, you can do it I think you can do it if you hook a Dell, like a Dell monitor. I think that their 30-inch will go. If you hook it to a PC with the right NVIDIA card or whatever, you can get it there.
I should fess up. I did the world's first podcast shot on a Red. So I'm like totally there with you. There is benefit in the exercise for the learning of it the doing of it.
Because you run into, like, when we shot the first Mac breaks, so the first Mac, except for the very first one, the first studio Mac breaks were shot at 1080p with a 950.
Yep.
You know, 444, and people thought we were crazy then. You know, so
no, I heard that argument.
Well, 4K, here's the thing is I think that YouTube is a great example of, I think that the whole 4K thing on YouTube is absurd.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm not saying that I'm thinking it's serious. It's like when I made my little iPhone rig, my handheld rig.
It
was absurd, and I know it was absurd. We all know it was absurd. But here's why I think YouTube's doing that. YouTube is shattering the idea that web video is tiny. You know, that web video is low resolution, that web video is all these things. They're going, okay, here's the deal. You know, we're now allowing you to put it up, even though no one's going to do it right now. You know, you're going to get to a point where you could play short films off of YouTube on your movie theater, you know, at a movie theater, you know, and I think that that's the press that they're kind of, you know, moving down the path with. And the thing is if we shoot it in 4K, for instance, I can put it up on, you know, put it up at 4K, and then they're going to do all the conversions for me. So I don't have to think about it. You know, like I put it up at 4K, and then a day later, it's going to come out at 1080p. And
yeah, so I'm not staying in this lovely hotel. I'm staying in the next one, and they have HD monitors in my room.
Yeah.
And I swear to God, it looks worse than old YouTube. And so my concern is they go to 4K, but then they compress the bajillicans out of it.
Well, that's going
to
be the next.
And so it's like a waste of, you know what I mean? Like you need to, like it isn't an end in itself. I personally think that, because I'm, you know, I'm a red guy, so I love shooting 4K for capture because it solves a whole bunch of problems with Nyquist frequency when I go down to 2K.
Right.
But that being said, it is not just a matter of saying it's 4K. It has to be 4K at what bit depth at capture. And then also
what sharpness, what and, level of grain.
And what data rate when you transmit it. And if you do 4K badly, you know, there's kind of no point. I mean, that blocky pixeling MPEG-y stuff you see on what is meant to be my HD monitor in the bedroom or the hotel room is just horrible.
Well, and I think that, like everything else, I always look at it as like, this is a step towards something more interesting.
Sure.
You know, and I think that I think Google is trying to handle the other end of 100 megabits to everybody. You know, and when we do that, we can start getting into, when we look at a Blu-ray is running at 35 megabits. So 100 megabits is three times the bandwidth of a Blu-ray, you know, and
I think it's a blocking action by Google. They're just simply stopping someone endgaming around them because Vimeo has a bit of a perception of being higher quality than YouTube.
Right.
So I think it's just, you know, it's as much that as anything. But hey, look, knock yourself out.
But what's happened is that there's a whole series of problems. So you end up with, first of all, you know, there was the, you know, Conduit, which is what we key a lot of our shows in.
I've used Conduit on productions in UK and stuff. It's great.
Well, in a GPU processor running in real time. Although the problem with real time, of course, is when you start putting 4K plates in, you end up with, you need a big GPU to suck that in. And it, so it took a little bit of running around to do that. And then the second problem was that QuickTime X, you know, we were doing screen captures with QuickTime X. Yeah, not really built for that kind of resolution. So it's skipping all over the place. The guys kind of figured that out. Then they got it all working. And then yesterday we were like, yeah, now we're running out of memory to render it to H.264. So that, you know, it's one thing after another that's kind of, but we're learning, you know, and that's why we do it. You know, the 1080p, the first 1080p that we did for MacBook took us 2 months to get out the other end. This will take 2 or 3 weeks. And all of these shows, I mean, everything, like what we're watching, if you're listening, what you're not seeing is we're sitting in a hotel in Los Angeles and we're streaming live from a backpack, which we're going to be wandering around with all day today. And all of this for us is just, you know,
research. Tell me it's the smaller of those two things over there.
It's the smaller of those two things. That little guy, so the little live view there is... Because
otherwise you'd need six Sherpas walking behind you.
Yeah, the other one. Yeah, no, this tiny little backpack's got six EVDO modems in it. So it's, you know,
You're going to... Yeah, I think... I don't know. Have you tested it on the show floor? Is it... Because there's big Wi-Fi internet problems down there with the interference from the...
Well, we're not using Wi-Fi. We're using cellular.
Okay.
Our cellular has worked pretty well. The phones have worked well. And we were in NAB, wandering all over NAB without any issues.
Oh, that should work well then.
So, and we'll find out. That's why we test it. But it's great because we did one of the... you know, we started testing it for these shows. I mean, that's why we're playing with it. But we went out when Marty Rosenberg was shooting his first short film. I think we were the first one to stream live from an actual feature film set, you know, because at this point we don't need to be connected to anything. We just turn it on.
So I say this tongue in cheek, that also the trouble with a live shoot is it's actually not as interesting as people think it is. Now you guys made it more interesting because you were like commenting on what was going on and people got asked questions and stuff. But quite frankly, if you gave me the opportunity just to watch somebody on a set.
Well, what we're doing another stream. We're going to do another one for the short film because we're like, I don't want to shoot a feature. I just want to shoot a short film because we only need a minute and a half, and then you're going to see.
People reckon that post is boring, but oh my god!
But we're going to one of the big things is that we're adding you know, commentary and color to it. So we're going to have two people just sitting there just talking about what everybody's doing. I think that's the only way you can really watch it.
Yeah,
is and let people like discuss stuff and ask questions. Anyway, I think we're running.
Should we do questions?
Yeah, I think we're going to open up to questions. So anyway, this mess, Mike Seymour. Where can people find you?
So in two places, actually, the stuff that I'm talking about, SIGGRAPH newsy stuff, we put on FX Guide, which is our since 97, is where we do that stuff. And then the other stuff we do, like the training and consulting, the sort of serious high-end stuff, we do on FXPhD.com.
And I highly recommend both.
Thanks, man.
If you're looking for the news, FX Guide is just an incredible resource. And if you're looking for training, I mean, I think that it is, you know, really some of the best visual effects training you can get. So definitely check it out. And it's very affordable for, you know, for the incredible amount that you're getting out of it.
A new term just started. So we're about the beginning of a term. We work in terms and you can enroll after the start of term. But we're very much like a fixed term. It's not a download on demand.
Right.
Because the person that's teaching is there to answer questions. And so people always say, why don't you run everything? It's like, well, because everybody's not available because they're in production. So if you were doing a course, which, you know, sort of thing that you would do, you would need to be available in the forums to do it. And that's worked out really well for us, so thanks.
Yeah. So definitely check that out. And this mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over.
This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.